So I'm very pleased to be here. Danke für die Einladen und die Einführung. I should begin with an apology, because I'm always very aware of the fact that my German over recent years has become much worse. Once upon a time, I might have been able to present a talk in German, but not any longer. I think this is partly a function of the hospitality of my German hosts, people like Hans Helmut and also Bernd, who don't necessarily challenge my German ability so much. But I also think it's an indication not only of what Wolfgang Hersbach talked about yesterday in terms of the dominance of English within the academic world, but it's also an indication of the handicap that English speakers have. We are not challenged to engage terribly much in other languages. And for some of us, it's difficult. In a place like Australia, it's a very, very monolingual culture, and that makes it much, much harder to really maintain, build and maintain one's foreign languages. So, es tut mir leid, I wish I could present this in German, but I think you would be much happier with me presenting it in English rather than me mangling the German language. I should also say that my engagement with Heidegger is somewhat unusual. My initial training was not in phenomenology or hermeneutics. I've very much found my own way to phenomenology and hermeneutics. My initial training was as an analytic philosopher. My teachers at the ANU were Jack Smart, J.J.C. Smart, one of the inventors of Australian materialism, and Philip Pettit, both of whom were working solidly within an English language analytic tradition. And much of my early work was on the philosophy of Donald Davidson. But I also worked on Dick Rorty, new Dick Rorty, as well as Davidson, and also Bert Dreyfus. And so I've come into Heidegger's studies essentially through a rather peculiar pathway, and a pathway that's also been oriented toward engaging, appropriating Heidegger, as well as hermeneutics, particularly hermeneutics, within an English language environment. So I've, in some ways, giving this in English is perhaps an indication that part of what I want to do is to take up the matters of Heidegger's thinking in a way that does not merely repeat what Heidegger said, which I think is characteristic of too much contemporary Heidegger scholarship, but to engage with the matters that are at issue there, to try and think through what demands thinking. And I think Heidegger remains an important thinker, no matter what one thinks of the Schwarze Hefte, because the matters that he brings to the fore are absolutely central, not only to academic philosophy, but to everyday life. Now, it happens that I didn't choose to speak on Heidegger's critique of humanism. I was asked by Bernd and Hans Helmut to talk about this, but it was a serendipitous choice, because the topic is one that's actually quite important in the work that I do, and the text that has to be the main focus for this discussion, which is the brief Über Humanismus, is also, in my reading, a particularly important text. What I'm going to do today is give you a reading of Heidegger's critique of humanism that looks particularly at the account that's there in the letter on humanism, but is very much driven by a set of considerations that I argue are, well, they're certainly at the centre of not only my reading of Heidegger, but my own particular philosophical trajectory. And therefore, to give you a reading that might be both idiosyncratic in my own terms, but that also tries to wrest Heidegger out of perhaps his own context and place him into a different one. And I'll say a little bit about that later. It actually relates very closely to the character, the problem of reading a text like the Schwarze Hefte, because I think, as I intimated yesterday, too much of our reading of these texts is naive, hermeneutically. Too much of it depends on trying to get a particular politics out of Heidegger or place Heidegger in a certain way in terms of contemporary thought and terms of contemporary movements. I don't think we spend enough time trying to actually make sense of what the real issues are that underpin Heidegger's thinking. I might add, too, that I also think the question of interpretation means that there is never any single one correct way of reading a thinker. In that respect, I'm already opposed to the idea that there is any essential Nazism or anti-Semitism in Heidegger's thinking, because those seem to me hermeneutically problematic approaches. Thinking is always more indeterminate, richer, more complex than would allow any such simple essentialist reading of a text. Although, as you'll see, I will make some claims about what seem to me to lie at the heart of Heidegger's thinking and at the heart of particularly the brief Überhumanismus. It ought to be, well, in the letter on humanism, in the brief, Heidegger at one point talks about, towards the end of the letter, about the way in which it ought to be clearer, having gone through the analysis of the pages that go before, that it ought to be clearer, he says, that the opposition to humanism that he sets out in the letter in no way implies a defense of the inhuman. Instead, he says, it opens up andere Ausblicke öffnet. It opens up other, in the English translation, other vistas, other views. Andere Ausblicke. But what are these andere Ausblicke that are opened up by this opposition to humanism? And in what does the opposition to humanism itself consist? Written in response to a letter from Jean Beaufret, dated November 10, 1946, in which Beaufret asked Heidegger a series of questions provoked by Sartre's 1945 lecture, Existentialism is a Humanism, the letter was first published in German in 1947 and in a partial French translation, French version in 1946, coming a year after the denazification proceedings that had led to Heidegger's breakdown in 1945. The letter can be seen as having its origins in Heidegger's desire to rehabilitate himself and his thought through an engagement with the great figure of French existentialism. And it actually followed on from Heidegger's own attempt to communicate directly and personally with Sartre, which didn't succeed. Robert de Noon Cumming, in his interesting set of volumes, Phenomenology and Deconstruction, one of which, the fourth volume, is titled Solitude, de Noon provides probably what is the most detailed account of the brief in its historical setting. And Cumming actually says quite explicitly that he wants to understand the way in which the brief, the letter, can be seen to be tied to the particularities of Heidegger's personal, political, and philosophical situation. And so Cumming talks about his approach, the way in which he reads the letter, as a, in his terms, a localizing of the work, and explicitly makes reference to the idea of this as an Erörterung, a term that Heidegger himself uses, most notably perhaps in the lecture of the Essay on Trakl. Cumming translates this into English as localizing discussion, which I think is an interesting translation, although it presents some problems as well. Now, the focus on place, on ought, that appears here is reinforced by the way Heidegger himself orients the letter. Taking the cue from Beaufret's question regarding ethics towards the end of the letter to focus on ethos, which Heidegger tells us means Aufenthalt, again often translated into the English as sojourn or dwelling place. As you'll see later on, I have some problems with the translation of these terms using the English dwelling, but that's another matter. And Cumming, who draws attention to this point, connects it with Heidegger's greeting to Jaspers much later on the latter's 80th birthday in 1963, where Heidegger says to Jaspers he hopes that he will be able to arrive at Gelangen and abide in Verweilen, that place in which his thinking has established an Aufenthalt, place for meditation. Now, in spite of the attention he gives to these matters, Cumming has very little to say about the thematization of place, of ortschaft, that seems to be at work in the letter. But it's quite clear that ortschaft has a role in the letter, in the brief, that goes well beyond its significance for any mere historical contextualization. And yet, Cumming tends to treat it just as a matter of historical contextualization. Now, I'm going to take up this notion of ought and ortschaft and with it Aufenthalt, but I'm going to do so in a way that is not merely about the historical contextualization of the letter, nor just of Heidegger's critique of humanism. The concern with place, Ort, Ortschaft, and with what Heidegger calls topologie, underpins all of Heidegger's thinking, at least as I read matters. And it doesn't only appear in the later thinking. It's implicitly at issue from the very beginning, even though it only starts to become explicit in the 1930s and principally in the context of Heidegger's engagement with Hölderlin, and most significantly in the pages of the Beiträge. Yet for much of the 1930s and into the 1940s, Heidegger's thinking of place, as with his thinking of so much else, remains entangled with the problematic thinking of the history of being that is all too often focused around Germany's own precarious position in the world. It's only with the end of the war, with Germany's collapse, and also perhaps with Heidegger's own breakdown, that a clearer focus begins to emerge. And it's here that the letter's so significant. For all that it can indeed be read as against the background of Heidegger's own attempt to rehabilitate himself in the wider philosophical world, it's also part of the rehabilitation of Heidegger's own thinking for himself as it emerges out of the difficulties of the previous decade or more, out of the difficulties that stem in no small part from Being and Time and from the success and the failure of that work. And I think it's not well acknowledged, not well understood, that in a way Being and Time is a problem for Heidegger. Being and Time is the great work that gets attention, but it's the great work that fails and that serves as a blockage for many, many years. In a way, what follows on from the publication of Being and Time in 27 are a series of attempts to try and overcome Being and Time itself. At least that's how I would suggest the matter can be read. And this goes on through the 1930s, and it seems to me that something from which Heidegger properly emerges, begins to emerge with the Beiträge, but properly emerges only with the letter in 1947. Part of what makes the Schwarze Hefte interesting, and their interest, I think, is actually limited, but part of what makes them interesting insofar as they are, is that they document the degree to which Being and Time catapults Heidegger into both a personal and a philosophical crisis at the same time as he also encounters the political crisis in which Germany finds itself in the 1930s. His engagement with Hitler is thus an unfortunate convergence of the political, the philosophical, and the personal. So, now in this respect, the rehabilitation that I think is going on in the letter, which is going on particularly in 46 and 47, and which I think you can actually see not only in the letter on humanism, but also in the Anmerkungen, the most recent volume of the Schwarze Hefte to appear. This rehabilitation of Heidegger's thinking can also be understood in my terms as a rehabitation, a finding again or returning to the proper place or habitus to which Heidegger's thinking belongs. And it's a process that can perhaps be seen to have already begun in the Beiträge in 1936. In this respect, Robert Cummings' invocation of the notion of Aufenthalt in the context of the 1946-47 letter seems entirely correct and highly relevant, even though Cummings doesn't read it in the way I have here. It's in the period from the letter onwards that it becomes evident just how important Ort and Ortschaft are for Heidegger, not only for his thinking of and with Hölderlin, or to his thinking of poetry and art, but to his thinking of being itself, and in a way that is no longer tied to the national historical or to the idea of Seinsgeschichte, which I think an idea which Heidegger largely abandons, sloughs away in the late 30s. Moreover, as Heidegger's thinking becomes more explicitly topological, so Heidegger comes more clearly to reject, or at least significantly to modify, some of the concepts and approaches of his earlier thinking, and not only those of Sein und Zeit. The letter on humanism, the brief Über Humanismus, thus represents a watershed in Heidegger's thinking. It's indeed a Wegmarken, but an especially important one. The letter represents, in fact, the culmination of a shift that had been underway in Heidegger's thinking since at least the mid-1930s, and that it has its origins in the failure of Sein und Zeit. The shift in thinking is what Heidegger himself refers to for the first time in the letter as the Kehre or turn. Now, the Kehre has become something of a contentious issue in contemporary Heidegger scholarship, particularly in English. And this is partly as a result of the work of Thomas Sheehan. Sheehan argues for a strong distinction between the carer, as the turning of being itself, and Heidegger's own Wendung, the shift that occurs in the way Heidegger's thought is expressed. Now, one can see why Sheehan is committed to this distinction as a result of his own concern to separate the early from the later thinking, and more especially to prioritise the early over the late. Sheehan, as it happens, has little time for the later Heidegger, and also sees Sein und Zeit as largely unaffected by the problems that he takes to be presented by Heidegger's entanglement with Nazism and anti-Semitism in the 30s and 40s. So in part, this distinction between the carer and the Wendung for Sheehan is part of his own attempt to rescue Sein und Zeit, which he thinks remains a work of philosophical significance, and his own reading of Heidegger, the reading that is there in the New Paradigm volume, which I think is actually just a repetition of a very old paradigm. It's that reading of Sein und Zeit that really drives all of the account that Sheehan gives there. Now, clearly there's a distinction to be made between Carer and Wendung, but a distinction doesn't preclude an identity. And if, unlike Sheehan, one takes the shift in Heidegger's thinking to be a genuine turning within the original problematic of his thought, and so an intensification of, rather than a falling away from, the insights and concerns in which it's founded, then one cannot properly separate, one cannot completely separate Carer from Wendung either. Now, this is in fact my own position. Because I take Heidegger's later thinking to be a continuation of the original thinking developing out of the failures that Heidegger encounters along the path of his thought and to which he responds, so I take the later thinking to bring us closer to what properly lay at the heart of that thinking all along. As it happens, this also involves a radicalization of thinking and a questioning of the very foundations, the very character of philosophical work. If the later thinking is therefore sometimes called mystical, I think that reflects more on the difficulties that many academic philosophers have in engaging with the radicality of Heidegger's thought rather than an indication of any real proximity to a mystical, to an obscurantist mode of thinking. Now, this way of reading relies on the reading of Heidegger from our current standpoint as a reading that's capable of going further than Heidegger's own readings of his work. This is so, it seems to me, for every thinker, as Heidegger himself acknowledged. In an important sense, the real essence of the work of a thinker can only be gauged by those who come after. This, it might be noted, has some significance for the reading of works such as the Schwarze Hefte. These offer no definitive key to the essence of Heidegger's thought any more than any other particular work offers a definitive key. I would argue because these are personal writings, they are probably even less reliable in that regard. So they offer no Schlüssel that opens up Heidegger's thought in some special way just because they are taken to be an expression of his private thoughts, but merely offer, at the most, more material to those of us that have the task of interpretation before us. They don't solve that problem of interpretation, not even the seemingly anti-Semitic and pro-Nazi passages. The question as to whether Heidegger's thinking is indeed tainted, a word that I think is problematic in this context, but I'll use it anyway, is tainted by Nazism or anti-Semitism, is not a matter merely of identifying what are taken to be pro-Nazi or anti-Semitic passages in Heidegger's work. It demands a more difficult and a more complex task of interpretation. No passage can be simply naively read, especially not out of context, and then assumed to be understood. The task of interpretation always lies before us. And as I say, in some cases, in almost all interesting cases, the task of interpretation will require that very often we understand the thinker at question in a way that goes against that thinker's own self-interpretations, own self-readings. In this respect, the thinker is no more a guide to the character of their own thought than is anybody else. What the thinker says about his or her own thought becomes simply another text for us to interpret. As I read Heidegger, the shift in his thinking that culminates in the letter is a shift that corresponds to his attempt to follow the turning of being itself. And it's no accident that this idea of turning has a spatial sense to it, a sense of turning round or back. and one might think here, knowing Heidegger's own interests, of the Spitzkehrer, the abrupt turn that a skier might perform. Since my claim, one advanced over some years and several works, and echoing a claim originally made by Joseph Fell in a book that is all too infrequently read, is that this turning is itself a turning that belongs to place, to topos, to ought, to ortschaft, and is also a turning back to this place, which is the place of being, die Ortschaft des Seins. The shift in Heidegger's thinking is thus a turn towards the explicit focus on and explication of what he calls Topologie des Seins, topology of being. The place at issue here is both the place that belongs to thinking as well as the place that belongs to being. Indeed, on this account, being and place belong essentially together. Now, the very phrase topology of being, topologie des Seins, emerges for the very first time in Heidegger's thinking at the time of the letter, even though it doesn't appear in the letter itself. The phrase appears in a line from one of the poems in The Thinker as Poet in the English translation from 1947, Aber das denkende Dichtung ist in der Wahrheit die Topologie des Seins. But it also appears several times in the pages of the Schwarze Hefte, in the volumes that have appeared as Anmerkungen from the same year, along with other key phrases such as Ortschaft des Seins. In fact, I was particularly pleased and interested when I looked at the Anmerkungen and found these phrases there, because these are phrases that surprisingly appear very infrequently in Heidegger's later thinking, even though they seem also to be absolutely central. A key element in the entries from this period, the entries in the Anmerkungen, is a concern with the place of thinking and the place of being, both as this relates to Heidegger's own thinking and to thinking and being as such. So Heidegger, for instance, writes that im Sommer 1936 kam mir die helle Erfahrung der Ortschaft, in der mein Denken schön bleiben musste. Diese Ortschaft ist das in Sein und Zeit genannt gesucht. So entstanden in diesem Sommer die Beiträge. And the English there is no English translation of that yet. But so the claim is that in the summer of 36, the contributions arrive, the Beiträge arrives, and it arrives with this sudden recognition of the place of Heidegger's own thinking. He also warns us in the same volume, for instance, that man kann sich mit Philosophie beschäftigen und dennoch für immer der Ortschaft des Denken fernbleiben. One can work with philosophy and yet forever avoid the place of thinking. It's a warning that he seems to be offering it. Perhaps it's a warning that applies as much to himself as to those who read him. The reference to the Beiträge, I think, is noteworthy. Although that work doesn't make the same clear reference to topology, so far as I can see, as I say, there is no reference to Topologie des Seins before 47, the contributions nevertheless seem to exemplify exactly what Heidegger suggests here, a concern with the place of thinking and the attempt to think that place. It is, one might say, with the Beiträge that the idea of topology, if not the term itself, first emerges. So I would suggest that if one goes back to the Beiträge and reads it with this later thinking in mind and with the framework of topology worked out, the Beiträge suddenly takes on a different meaning, a different significance, appears as itself a different sort of clearing. I think that's a task yet to be done in terms of the secondary reading of the Beiträge, something I've tried to do a little bit but haven't done very much. It's a task that I think places the Beiträge in a very different light. Now, this concern with the place of thinking must not be read as if it were simply a way of speaking of the contextual situatedness of thought or of the situatedness of any interpretive engagement with thinking, which is sort of how Cumming takes it. The notions of context and of interpretive situation themselves carry a topological significance, and I've actually talked about this elsewhere. Not only is that significance routinely overlooked or ignored, however, but in this case, to treat what is at issue is primarily about just such notions and nothing more, is to step back from the more fundamental topology to which Heidegger's language here directs us. the place of thinking is the very place of being. And this is necessarily so once one realizes that the inquiry into being can only proceed by means of an inquiry that also attends to that which thinking itself is. The question of being contains with it from the very beginning the question of thinking, just as the question of thinking carries within it the question of being. The intimate connection between the question of the place of thinking and the place of being is made quite explicit by Heidegger himself, and nowhere more so than in the Anmerkungen, in this most recent volume of the Schwarze Hefte. There he writes, "Wie sollen wir die Überlieferung des Standes der Denkenden pflegen, wenn wir die Ortschaft dieses Standes nicht kennen? Diese Ortschaft ist die Wahrheit des Seins. Wer geht heute noch auf die Wanderschaft in diese Ortschaft?" Once place is seen as a central concept, and the turning is understood as a turning to place, then one can see more clearly why it might indeed be that the human cannot be given primacy in this account. And here we come, if you like, to the question of humanism. The human is essentially placed. The human stands in an essential relation to the Da, to the Ought. And yet the being placed of the human, being placed as such, is not identical with place. This point was already evident, though not in quite these explicitly topological terms, in Sein und Zeit, and especially in the Kantbuch of 1929. In the latter work, Heidegger makes the claim, an oft-repeated claim, that the more basic than Dasein, more original than Dasein, he says, is the finitude of Dasein in him. More original than man is the finitude of the Dasein in him. And already this can be seen to prefigure the argument of the letter, even though it makes no explicit reference to humanism as such. It's this claim, and together with it Heidegger's rejection of the Kantian claim for the priority of philosophical anthropology, that was of course the focus for instance, Martin Buber's critique of Heidegger. And one can find sympathy for Buber's approach, for Buber's critique, at the same time as one can also understand the point of Heidegger's own original position. Similarly, in the Beiträger, Heidegger again emphasizes the priority of Dasein over the human and rejects any reading that would prioritize the human as subject. In fact, he argues that this understanding of the human subject is the understanding that problematically and persistently underpins all of contemporary, of modern philosophy, from Descartes and his followers, says Heidegger, even including Nietzsche, who he seems to here characterize as a follower of Descartes. Well, or at least as his opponent, but insofar as he has, as his opponent, still also standing within under the sway of Descartes. And it's this idea of the human as subject and of the priority of the human as subject that Heidegger identifies as problematic. And in the Beiträger, he goes on in a way that both echoes his earlier discussion as well as presaging what is to come in the letter, including the turn towards place, expressed both in terms of the focus on Dasein, the hyphenation reinforcing its topological component, and the realm, the Reich, that is the clearing of being. And he's very clear in the Beiträger. He writes, "Dieser Bereich der Lichtung des Seins jedoch ist durch und durch nicht menschlich, nicht bestimmbar und nicht tragbar durch das Animal Rationale und ebenso wenig durch das Subjektum. Der Bereich ist überhaupt kein Seindes, sondern gehört der Wesung des Seins." In summary terms, one might say that although the question of being is only approached through the question of the human, since it always implicates the question of the being of the one who questions and who else can question, the question of being cannot be reduced to the question of the human. Being is not self-identical with the human. Moreover, once the nature of the question of being is recognized, and so also the proper relation of human being to that question is understood, then one is forced to recognize that what comes first here is the clearing of being, the there of being, in which even human being comes first to find itself. Rather than thinking the human as if it were indeed some primal phenomenon, as if it were that from which all other phenomena flow, We must first think the place of the human, but that means thinking place first, thinking place itself. Thinking the essence of the human means thinking place, because the being of the human is essentially placed being. That's why Sein und Zeit can take, if you like, that which underlies the question of the human as the question of Dasein. Human being is a being given over to the there, to the place, the Ortschaft, Ort, as Heidegger emphasizes almost from the very start. This place is not merely to be identified with the place of the human, as if it were a place already determined as human. To take such an approach would indeed be to retain the commitment to a prior conception of the human being, when not only is the human that which is itself, when the human is that which is itself open to question. And this already appears as a problematic feature of humanism, namely, that it depends on assuming that which remains essentially obscure, the human itself. Moreover, the very appearance of the human already presupposes the place of that appearance, as every appearance depends on such a place. In contrast, the human must be determined from place and not place from the human. And this is so even though, as I said, understanding can only approach place from and through the human and through the place of the human. I've emphasized the continuity of the letter with Heidegger's early thinking a little, even as I've also singled it out as marking a key point in the shift in Heidegger's thinking towards a more explicitly topological orientation. In this respect, what occurs in the letter is a certain sort of recapitulation, as well as a clarification and explication of Heidegger's previous thinking, as much as it also points towards, and may even be said to set the framework for, what comes after. The letter stands in a particularly important relation to the essay from 1940, which itself goes back to a lecture course of 1931, Plato's Doctrine of Truth, and the relation is especially illuminating since it helps to illuminate the continuity that's at issue here. Plato's Doctrine of Truth concerns itself with a theme that's already presaged in Sein und Zeit, the question of truth itself. The essay ends, however, with a brief discussion of humanism and the assertion of the identity of the beginning of metaphysics with the beginning of humanism. Both have their origin in the movement of human beings to a central place among beings. And of course, you will know that the letter on humanism first appears in the same volume along with the lecture on Plato, on the doctrine of truth. Yet Plato's doctrine of truth also takes as its focus an examination of what Plato presents to us as the place of our dwelling, which in an everyday way is revealed to us as we look around, and that's how it's characterized by Heidegger. Not only is this place shown to be a place of illusion, so that our place turns out to be a place of imprisonment in which we are already cut off from what is real, cut off, one might say, from being, but that place allows access to the real only through understanding it as being that which is only secondarily real. Truth is dependent on this account on our relatedness to what lies beyond and outside of the place in which we immediately find ourselves. This is a view that it seems to me isn't peculiar to Plato, but in some way or another probably is present in and underpins almost the entirety of Western philosophy and still dominates within a great deal of analytic thinking. Heidegger's own thinking of truth can be interpreted as a thinking that attends, no less than does Plato, to the place of our dwelling, if we're to use that term. But unlike Plato, Heidegger takes truth to belong to this very place. As is evident from his discussions of truth elsewhere, truth understood as aletheia, truth is not some relation to what lies beyond or outside. Instead, it arises in the play of hiddenness and unhiddenness to which we already given over, in the play of that place in which we already find ourselves. Once again, however, it's important to emphasize that this place, this ought, even though it is grasped only in and through our human being in place, is not a place that is derived from the human, nor is it reducible to the human. It stands apart from the human, it's nicht menschlich, even though it also belongs essentially with it. Now, the relation between human being and the place of being is one that Heidegger describes in the letter on humanism and elsewhere in terms of the idea of Wonen. Now, this term is usually translated in English, standardly translated into English as dwelling. This is a translation, like many other Heideggerian terms, that has almost given rise to peculiarities, a completely different reading of Heidegger in English than one might find in the original text. Dwelling has very little connection with the German Wonen. Wonen is an ordinary term, and I think it's characteristic of Heidegger, for instance, in Bauen, Wonen, Denken, that when he begins with this question about what is Wonen, that beginning is with a questioning of something that we already think we know. That's why he begins with Wonen. We all think, you know, wo Wonen sie? Yeah, obvious question, easy question. We know how to answer questions like that. We know what Wonen is. Okay, we know what it is to live somewhere, as one might say in English. But when one translates it into English as dwelling, and one says, what is it to dwell? This is a strange question in English. Already, Heidegger suddenly appears, Bauen, Wonen, Denken, appears now, not as an essay that begins with something ordinary and everyday and then makes it problematic, but with something that is already problematic and makes it more so. Dwelling is not a common term in English. In fact, dwelling appears in English in probably only two places. Occasionally in architectural discussions where dwelling means a residence or a building, and then in writings about Heidegger. My preference would be to abandon the term altogether. The difficulty in English is that there is no term that exactly corresponds to the German Wonen. So one can try and translate it as to live, but to live, again, while it connects with the notion of Wonen, so if you ask somebody, wo Wonen sie in English, where do you live? Yeah. But live, of course, carries other connotations. So the difficulty in English is that we have no adequate term to translate it. I think that means in English that if one's to preserve the intention of Heidegger's thinking, one has to try and translate it in ordinary ways. Perhaps in terms of trying to rethink what it means to live somewhere, what it means to be in the world, what it means to have a home somewhere. These are terms that capture more readily what's at issue in Heidegger's thinking and avoid some of the mystification, some of the problematization that goes with this ridiculous translation of Wonen as dwelling. But it's a translation that's almost impossible to escape in English. Now, Wonen is a term that already appears in Sein und Zeit, as Heidegger points out in the letter. And Wonen is also a term that has to be read as already implicated with the thinking of place. To be in a place is not, as Heidegger argues in Sein und Zeit, a matter of mere spatial containment. The human being is not in place like one Russian doll inside another. And neither is place itself identical with simple location. Wonen implies place, implies ought, since to dwell, if we're to use the English term, is precisely to stand in a certain relation to place. Now, the relation at issue here is a relation of the sort that Heidegger already refers to in Sein und Zeit, in part, as care, sorge. So we can say that to dwell, Wonen, is to attend and respond to place, and elsewhere Heidegger talks about sparing, about caring for, all these sorts of ideas that seem to involve a certain sort of comportment toward place as being constitutive of Wonen. However, the relation of Wonen, the relation in which human beings find themselves to place that's captured by this term Wonen, is not merely one that requires a certain response on the part of human beings, nor does it consist only in such responsiveness. Fundamentally, Wonen has to be understood as encompassing the character of human being as indeed already standing in a relation to place, as essentially placed. Our own sorge, our own care in respect of place, is derivative of this. This prior relatedness to place can be understood in terms of the dependence of human being on place, not merely in the sense that human lives are shaped by the places in which they are lived, but in the sense that it is also only in and through place that human lives take on any shape at all, that they appear as human. Such dependence is not diminished by the fact that place itself, that is, the clearing of being, which one might also say is the clearing of human being, emerges only in relation to language, and so in relation to human, the human. Human being is precisely that being whose own mode of being is bound to language. And this also implies an intimate connection between language and place, though it's a connection that I don't have time to go into here. The primary event, however, is not the appearing of human being, but of being itself, which is then only grasped in relation to human being. Wonen is thus the term Heidegger comes to use to describe the mode of being that is human and that emerges in the event of being. It is also Heidegger's response, one might say, to the difficult question, the question that he talks about as in including within it a distressing difficulty concerning the relation of being to human being. Human being, mortal being, plays a necessary role in the event of being, and yet it is not that in which the event of being is itself founded. Towards the end of the letter, in fact, the question of human being is raised directly in relation to the question concerning the possibility of an ethics. Now, I indicated something of this earlier in the way in which Heidegger takes up the notion of ethos and connects it to the notion of Aufenthalt. So this question about the nature of human being, the nature of Wonen, becomes in the letter on humanism tied up with this question too of the possibility of a fundamental ethics. Now Heidegger responds to this, as I've already intimated, by asserting that ethos bedeutet Aufenthalt, ort des Wohnens. Das Wort nennt den offene Bezirk, worin denn der Mensch wohnt. Das offene seines Aufenthaltes lasst das erscheinen. Was auf des Wesen des Menschen so kommt und also ankommend in seiner Nähe sich aufhält. Soll nun gemäß der Grundbedeutung des Wortes Ethos der Name Ethik, die sagen, dass sie den Aufenthalt des Menschen bedenkt, dann ist derjenige Denken, dass die Wahrheit des Seins als das anfängliche Element des Menschen, als eines Existierenden, denkt in sich schon die ursprüngliche Ethik. Ethics here is not treated as the realm of prescriptive principle, but rather concerns a recognition of our own prior belonging. Such a view leads on to a very different conception of the ethical than is usually the case. One that brings us closer to the later thinking, perhaps in Heidegger's terms of Gelassenheit, though not in the sense of a quietism, so much as in of attentive responsiveness. If we were to take seriously what is at issue here and move it beyond merely the text of Heidegger's own thinking, to think against Heidegger as much as with him, as I think we have to, then it might also move us in the direction of the sort of account that one can find in Levinas and in many other thinkers, an account in which the ethical and the ontological come together in a fundamental way and in which both speak to the fundamental being of the human and in which the human is fundamentally at stake. And yet this is not a humanism. Exactly what this sort of the form such a topological ethics might take requires further elaboration. But it certainly cannot be taken to converge simply in any naive sense with any reactionary politics or with the refusal of ethical concerns. And that's true in spite of the fact that Heidegger might himself have become entangled in such politics. Again, I would say this provides in part a demonstration of the extent to which a thinker is not always the best guide to the character of his own or her own thought. Heidegger's critique of humanism, no less than his topology, is not some later intrusion into his thinking, but has its origins in the very nature of that thinking, in its focus on the question of being. The critique of humanism is thus as central to Heidegger's thinking as is the question of being itself. Indeed, you can already see how the very focus on being as a question implies a rejection of what humanism is traditionally understood to mean. Moreover, as the question of being is increasingly comes to be understood by Heidegger as a question concerning the place of being, so what also emerges is that the question concerning the place of the human, of that wherein human beings find their place in the world, of that of Vonnegut, if you like, that the critique of humanism is indeed so central to Heidegger's thought is especially important, given the way in which that critique might otherwise be seen as suggesting connections back to Heidegger's entanglement with Nazism. In fact, Heidegger's anti-humanism predates that, and so one might argue is itself incompatible with the German political humanism, which Alfred Rosenberg, as Carsten Hari's reports matters, took to be itself associated with Nazism. And it's interesting, a recent book on humanism called Sapiens identifies a number of varieties of humanism, of which it takes fascism to be one example. One can argue about that, but certainly I think there are good arguments that can be advanced to suggest that that's not an unreasonable connection. In this latter respect, however, even though Heidegger's anti-humanism is a feature of his early as well as his later work, the way the critique of humanism is developed in the letter can be seen as itself containing with it an implicit critique of some of Heidegger's earlier ideas, as I've said, including ideas bound up with his own espousal of Nazism. If one of the concerns of this meeting is with Heidegger's seduction by ideology, then far from being some continuation of such ideological seduction, Heidegger's critique of humanism ought to be seen as implicitly a critique of and offering the grounds for a rejection of ideology itself. And this remains so even though we also need to beware of the limitations of Heidegger's own capacity to carry this critique through to his own self-understanding. The critique of humanism is thus a critique of those isms, those ideologies, of which humanism is perhaps the most significant and encompassing that bedevil thought. It is worth noting too that the sense of humanism can be said to include not only the traditional humanisms with which we are familiar, not excluding the Renaissance humanism championed by Ernesto Grassi, but also all of those subjectivisms that one way or another take the human or the realm of the human as primary, which, as Heidegger puts it, make the human the measure. Of these, perhaps the most pervasive contemporary examples are constructionism, which takes all phenomena as essentially produced by the human in one way or another, or also scientism or objectivism, which reassert the primacy of the human through their very neglect, even refusal, of the human and of that to which the question of the human itself points. Now, for some, of course, the claim that humanism might be in any significant way problematic, that it might even be an ideology that can be connected to Nazism itself, will appear a dangerous and reactionary idea. Thinking itself is probably dangerous and reactionary on this account. But so far as Heidegger is concerned, even to obscure the real nature of Heidegger's own political culpability. Yet to be a critic of humanism is not thereby to be a Nazi, just as to be a critic of liberalism is not by that very fact to be a fascist or even a conservative. Moreover, neither humanism nor liberalism, nor either constructionism or scientism, offer an unequivocally benign face. Indeed, one of the lessons of the 20th century and of the 21st, as of the 19th as well, is that both humanism and liberalism can carry within them anti-human and even anti-liberal consequences and tendencies, may even take on anti-human and anti-liberal forms. From the perspective of the analysis offered in the letter, it is precisely the metaphysical character of humanism, which also means its subjectivism, that underlies the equivocal character of humanism, and for that one might argue of all ideologies, all isms. The critique of humanism is thus itself directly tied to both the practice of and the inquiry into thinking, Heidegger's own thinking no less than thinking itself. The critique of humanism is an attempt more clearly to say what thinking is, and therefore necessarily to think the place of thinking. Heidegger's own thinking is at issue here, no less than thinking itself, as I say. And this task is one carried on most obviously in Was heißt Denken, in which similar themes take centre stage and in which, even if humanism is not so directly taken up, there is also a clear focus on the problems of subjectivism and the prioritisation of the human. Why, given that the topological character of Heidegger's thinking by the time of the letter is so self-evident, has this character been so consistently and continually overlooked or ignored? Because it has. That it has seems very clear. Within the existing Heidegger scholarship, only a handful of thinkers have taken seriously the role of topology in Heidegger's thought, and even fewer have attended to the topology present in the Letter on Humanism. Even when the topological language Heidegger employs is pointed out or noticed, the tendency is invariably to treat it as metaphorical or figurative. Yet Heidegger tells us that it is not so. In the Letter on Humanism, he's quite explicit in telling us that not only the language of the house of being, but also the language of being in the world, of Wonen, the language that he employs in relation to Hölderlin when he talks of the idea of Wonen as the way in which human beings are on the earth, these are not etymological plays, he says. Nicht etymologische Spielerei. This is not the carrying over of one image, the image of house onto being. This is not metaphor. This is not play. This is not the adornment of language, he says, by poetry in an attempt to somehow save it from being scientific. So there's no metaphor here. When Heidegger says language is the house of being, he's not giving you a metaphor. So what is he telling you? I think that ought to be something that provokes us to think, because it's not actually just a question about Heidegger's thought alone. The language of place is so deeply founded in all of our thinking and speaking, in all of our experience, and yet it's a language that we invariably fail to attend to. It's a language that we invariably put to one side as merely a metaphor. Now, I'm not suggesting that this means that we have to take it as literal either. It may be, however, that the very distinction between the metaphoric and the literal falls into abeyance here. That when one engages in this sort of fundamental thinking, the metaphoric and the literal cease to have their usual meaning. I would argue, in fact, that when we come to do ontology, when we come to do fundamental thinking of the sort that Heidegger's doing, there are no metaphors. Whether they're what we are to take that to mean is another question. The tendency, when it's not simply overlooked, to treat Heidegger's topological language as metaphorical seems to me to be symptomatic of a widespread and deeply rooted tendency on the part of philosophers to disregard the placed character of thinking, even of their own thinking, and to view place, if it is attended to at all, as a secondary, derivative, and largely irrelevant concept whose ubiquity is simply a consequence of the ubiquity of topological and spatial metaphors more generally. Philosophical thinking thus draws constantly on the language of place. There is an unwritten history of philosophy that is to do with the Vergessenheit des Ortes, if you like. It draws constantly on the language of place and yet constantly forgets place, disregards it, overlooks it. It's characteristic of Heidegger's thinking, even though it might be thought to rely centrally on a range of such topological metaphors, that it refuses such metaphoric readings. As such, it insists that we pay attention to the way in which the topographic, ort, ortschaft, topos, place, the way these play a fundamental role in all of our thinking, that we pay attention to the very character of topology, that we pay attention to the very character of topology as it operates in language itself, that we do in fact listen to language. However, the refusal of metaphor that's involved here doesn't imply that Heidegger's language is therefore given over to a simple univocity or determinacy. What comes to the fore in Heidegger's thinking, especially the late thinking, is a mode of speaking that is not metaphorical and yet retains an essential vibrancy, what I've sometimes referred to, following Dieter Henrich, as an iridescence, and that belongs to language as such. Such vibrancy is not the same as mere ambiguity, nor does it stand in a mode of equivocity that remains merely within the contrast established by the pairing of equivocity and univocity. Heidegger's rejection of metaphor goes hand in hand with this assertion of the essential vibrancy of language. Yet this vibrancy does not belong only to language. It's a vibrancy that belongs to the event and to being, to nearness and the dimension, a vibrancy that belongs to word and thing, a vibrancy that is also present in the Wonen of human being. This is why the metaphorical can have no role here, because poetry is already given in the vibrancy of things themselves, and poetry, I would argue, is a response to that essential vibrancy. In the original and originary saying of language, by which the thing is called forth, by which it is let into the open, by which it is placed. If we fail to attend to the way place appears in the letter, not as metaphor, but as an originary phenomenon in itself, then we will fail to understand what is at issue in the critique of humanism and the insistence on looking beyond the human alone. What then are the andere Ausblicke that Heidegger's critique of technology opens up? I would argue that they are the vistas, the perspectives, the prospects that belong to the thinking of place, the bounded openness that belongs to place. When we move beyond the narrow thinking of traditional humanism and the subjectivism of metaphysics. But this means that the critique of humanism is in no way a rejection of the human, but a return to it in a more fundamental sense. What is essential to the thinking of place is the thinking of the character of appearance as based in boundedness and openness. And this is what surely also lies at the heart of human being. It's what's at issue in the idea of finitude. It's not the power of the human, then, but precisely the fragility and finitude of human being that is at issue here. This is tied to its placidness. It is directly tied to the topological character of the human and to the fundamental character of topology as such. If this is not always fully recognized in Heidegger, and to what extent it is so recognized is arguable on both sides, then this only shows how much every thinker remains to some extent blind to the full implications of their thought. The critique of humanism appears in its most explicit form in the letter, and Heidegger has little to say in relation to the term either before or after that work. Yet what's at issue in the critique of humanism is clearly at work in Heidegger's work, early as well as late. The critique of humanism is tied to Heidegger's concern to find a way back to the question of being, which he also comes to understand as a question about the place of being. That question of being and of place are seen to come prior to the question of the human, even though that question is approached through the human and even though it returns us back to the human. The critique of humanism is closely tied to the critique of technological modernity that is also present in the early work but develops in more refined form in the latter. And I would suggest that Heidegger's critique of technological modernity is fundamentally a critique based in this idea of topology of being. And indeed, it's partly the way in which technological modernity changes the character of place or seems to change it that is fundamental to understanding the character of this critique. And it's also a critique, I might say, that is as much a critique of contemporary corporate and bureaucratic capitalism as it is of any particular technological device. That means that we need to rethink what capitalism thing is in topological terms also. This follows, it seems to me, from the fundamental character of the connection between being and place. To understand technological modernity in ontological terms, technological modernity must also be understood in topological terms, since the topology of being is what ontology becomes once the relation of being and place is acknowledged. Humanism plays a central role in the development of technological modernity, and yet it does so in a complex way. Part of this complexity resides in the fact that technological modernity seems to set the human at the centre at the same time as it subjugates even the human. And as I was suggesting last night, a nice example of this is the mobile phone, which is presented as that which gives you control over a great many things, but is actually that to which you are always subjugated yourself. It's a small example, but actually I think quite a useful one. To what extent does Heidegger's anti-humanism tend Heidegger's thinking towards a reactionary politics? I'm actually not sure whether any real sense can be attached to this question. The connections between ideas are more complex than such a question seems to presuppose. And the fact that certain ideas may, in some contexts, be taken to lead to one set of outcomes but elsewhere to another is indicative of both the indeterminacy that is characteristic of thought as well as the uncertain and serendipitous character of human lives. In an important sense, a sense that perhaps Heidegger was not always himself fully aware of, Heidegger's anti-humanism actually seems to imply a rejection of the politics that has traditionally been associated with both the left and the right, and it certainly ought to force us to a more critical examination of humanism itself and of its contemporary manifestations as well as its contemporary perpetuation. Thank you.
jemand andere Fragen? Also beginnen hier. Trafni.
English, German.
Sie können Deutsch und Englisch sprechen.
Oh, I have to choose.
Go on, try German and aber langsam.
Okay.
Und deutlich.
Okay. Zwei Fragen. Die eine Frage betrifft Ihre Äußerung, wenn ich das richtig verstanden habe, zum möglichen antisemitischen Charakter einer Philosophie. Sie sagten in dem Sinn nach, das kann eigentlich gar nicht sein. Also Philosophie könne nicht antisemitisch sein, weil sie sei immer reicher. Das verstehe ich nicht und deswegen würde ich gerne Sie fragen, ob Sie das etwas erläutern könnten. Also sehen Sie, man kann doch meiner Ansicht nach behaupten, dass es in Kant antijudaistische, wie soll ich sagen, Topoi gibt, dass Kant natürlich Kants Philosophie als Ganze dadurch nicht antijudaistisch wird. Das ist klar. Aber warum können wir nicht sagen, zum Beispiel in Kants Religionsphilosophie gibt es antijudaistische Aspekte? Und die zweite Sache ist die, und das ist vielleicht nicht zufällig, dass ich auf Levinas hinweisen möchte. Sie haben von einer topologischen Ethik gesprochen. Das ist, wenn ich das so, Sie kennen Heidegger, Gagarin et nous, also Heidegger, Gagarin und wir. Vom Levinaschen Gesichtspunkt aus ist das ein Paradox. Es gibt keine topologische Ethik. Ja. Das ist, wenn Sie Topos sagen, können Sie nicht Ethik sagen. Also ich möchte, vielleicht können Sie das noch etwas ausführen.
Okay, so two questions. I might take the second first, the question about Levinas and a topological ethics. I think anybody who reads Levinas has to be struck by the extent to which his language is full of the language of place, and not simply of exilic place, but of the very encounter with another, which is an encounter that is with that very other. So I think Levinas is complex. On the one hand, there is, for instance, in his essay on Heidegger and Gagarin, a critique of Heidegger's own topology, and yet it's a critique that in some ways seems not to recognize perhaps, well, it's playing out a number of different things there. So I would argue that there is a very deep topological element at work in Levinas's work as much as in Heidegger, and that again, one mustn't take too seriously a philosopher's own account of their own work, that one has to really try to think through the problems that are at issue here. I mean, I actually think that the question of a topological ethics is a very important one, that it appears in Levinas's work, that it appears, interestingly enough, in Adam Smith's work. Adam Smith is a much more interesting ethical philosopher than any of his contemporary acolytes would give him credit for. It's certainly there in Heidegger's work, and I've also tried to draw it out of, for instance, Davidson's linguistic philosophy. We could say I was really only touching on that here. There is a much larger project of working out exactly how a topological ethics is to be understood and how ethics and ontology are to be understood as related together. But I take your point, there is a prima facie difficulty in doing that with Levinas. I would argue, though, that, as I say, as soon as one starts to read Levinas with an eye to the language of place that's actually at work in his thinking, and I think one of the paradoxes of Levinas is that on the one hand he does seem to deride the notion of topos and yet on the other hand constantly to deploy it, that there's another possibility that's opened up there. On the first question, I have to admit, I am not sure what it means to say of a philosophy that it is anti-Semitic. I'm not even sure what it means, what the identity conditions, if I'm going to revert to my analytic upbringing, what the identity conditions are for a philosophy such that can be attributed such a character. Of course, there are anti-Semitic passages and elements that one can find in philosophies and in positions and in thoughts and in works. But what really can it mean to say that a philosophy, where the notion of a philosophy must itself be put in question here, where that the notion of a philosophy is anti-Semitic or is Nazi or even is liberal or whatever, there is always a question of, first of all, a question about the identity conditions for a philosophy, as I say. What makes a philosophy this determinate thing, if you like, such that it has a certain character? So there's a fundamental logical issue. But secondly, there's a hermeneutic issue. Philosophies never come in tidy little bundles. Okay, here's the philosophy, it's all wrapped up, you can now take it home. Oh yes, it's an anti, you'd like a non-anti-Semitic one, we'll give you that as well. Philosophies aren't like that. Philosophies, like all thinking, are inherently indeterminate. They carry multiplicities within them. As soon as one accepts that a philosopher might not understand their own thought, or that their thought might be better understood by those that come after, then one is necessarily given over to the possibility that one, to the fact that one cannot characterize philosophies in such a straightforward way. So if you adopt the what I would take to be a fundamentally hermeneutic perspective, as I've been doing here, a perspective that I would say is more attentive to the character of interpretation, to the indeterminacy of ideas, to the complex character of thought, and so to the complex character of a philosophy, then I find it, as I say, I find it difficult to see how one can genuinely make sense of a claim such as the claim that a philosophy, whether it's Kant's or Heidegger's, is anti-Semitic or whatever. So, and this isn't just an issue that I have in relation to Heidegger and anti-Semitism. I mean, the claims, for instance, that are made that Enlightenment thought is inherently racist. I agree, of course, there are obviously racist elements in Enlightenment thought, but Enlightenment thought is itself inherently racist? I'm not sure what that can possibly mean, or how one could actually definitively demonstrate that. So I think possibly what divides us is a deeper issue about the character of thought, the character of a philosophy, and perhaps on my part, the adoption of a much more strongly hermeneutic perspective, which you might, of course, want to reject on the grounds that already puts me in sympathy more so with Heidegger, given his role in 20th century hermeneutics.
Ich habe jetzt noch drei Fragen. Ich würde die gerne zusammennehmen, denn ich muss auch auf die Zeit
warten.
Wir haben noch zwei Vorträge.
Es tut mir leid, ich habe zu lange gesprochen.
Zunächst Herr Dornberg, Herr Thome und Herr Esbach.
Ja, Sie entwickeln eine topologisch orientierte Sichtweise auf Heidegger. Zwei Fragen dazu. Sie haben ja schön dargestellt sozusagen, dass the place makes the human and not the human makes the place.
Ja, ja. Genau.
Und wie verhält sich diese seinsgeschichtliche Frage dazu? Ja, Rainer Martin hat ja dargestellt, dass wenn man von dort ausgeht, man Heidegger sozusagen vernichten kann und verlassen muss, sage ich jetzt mal. Ja, man könnte ja sagen, der Ort macht die Seinsgeschichte und nicht die Seinsgeschichte macht den Ort. Ja, also wenn Sie sich dazu positionieren. Und die zweite Frage war, wenn der Ort wichtig ist, gäbe es da Anschlussmöglichkeiten auch zu einem Konzept, was Christian Bermes entwickelt hat, bezüglich der Lebensdienlichkeit. Ja, wenn, also bezüglich des Bios oder einer philosophischen Biologie oder Anthropologie. Also wenn der Ort so wichtig ist, das Wohnen, das Living. Ja. Okay.
Würden Sie die gleich weitergeben?
Eric, thank you. I'm still puzzled by what I perceive as a tension within Heidegger's work, that he talks about place and all these things on the one hand, and that he repeatedly talks about the path and the, you know, the paths instead of works, the motto for the Gesamtausgabe and so on and so forth, and that he's on the move, on the way, and so on. And his own solution seems to be that he moves back and forth on the Feldweg. So, and this is a kind of a faked movement in a way. So I'm wondering whether your topology needs some kind of an amendment in the sense that there are two ways of relating to space. One would be settling in, and the other would be passing through or being on the move, which would turn Nietzsche as the main alternative to the main, which would turn Nietzsche into the main alternative to Heidegger, because his topology would be a topology of someone who is on the move.
Okay, I'm going to leave your question. Oh, es gibt noch.
Yeah, bitte. Okay,
danke. Wir können.
Wir machen das später.
Ja.
Wir diskutieren später. Okay,
okay, so I want to respond to your questions first and then come back to this question. Firstly, I'm not that much interested in Seinsgeschichte. I think it's a problem. And Heidegger actually says in the Anmerkungen that one of the things he realizes with the overcoming of being, as it were, is that he has to give up on Seinsgeschichte as well. Okay, and so on my account, topologie overtakes Seinsgeschichte. Right, so that's a very, very quick answer on that one. The idea that in looking at Vernon, we have to look at Leben, we have to look at the biologic. There are a number of elements in my answer to that. Firstly, I think that it is possible to go back and to rethink what a philosophical anthropology might be. So that's why that was partly lay behind my very brief comment about Buber's response to Heidegger on this question. I think there is something of interest to be explored in Buber's response, even as one also has to hold on to what it is that is concerning Heidegger. And in fact, I've just received a grant for a project on the I called Place Commonality in the Human Towards a New Philosophical Anthropology with a colleague of mine, Andrew Benjamin, which we're hoping we might be able to do some work on here in Freiburg. So I think there's a really important question about philosophical anthropology that reemerges now because the question of the human is so much at stake. But that philosophical anthropology would be different on my account from the sort of anthropology you find in someone like Plessner. So it would be much more specifically ontological rather than looking at the biological. And to that extent, I would probably take issue with some of the discussion we had yesterday about, you know, the turn back to Leben, to life. But there's a lot more to say about that. The question you put, my answer has a number of parts to it. Of course, there's a tension in Heidegger's work. That's one of the reasons why it's interesting. But also my relation to Heidegger, and this is partly quite important in terms of what I've been saying, my relation to Heidegger, I am not interested in some respects in Heidegger the person, nor am I particularly interested in Heidegger scholarship. I'm not a Heidegger scholar. Yeah, that's probably why my German's so bad. I'm interested in what the opportunity Heidegger gives us for thinking, to engage with the questions that are important to us now. So I'm quite happy to jettison bits of Heidegger if I need to. Now, sometimes I'm more polemical about putting that than in other cases because, of course, I am engaged in dealing with Heidegger's text and I'm trying to think through Heidegger. But I'm not interested in Heideggerian. I'm not interested in merely repeating what Heidegger says, and I think too much of the Heidegger scholarship in the past has been like that. So I'm happy that there are tensions. But I don't think that there is a tension between this idea of being on the way and being in one place. One of the people who I've engaged with recently is the Scottish poet Kenneth White, who works in France. And Kenneth and I have had a few discussions about this because Kenneth's work is composed of poetry plus a set of books. One set of books are very much what he calls stay books, detailed engagements with particular places. The other set of books are what he calls way books, all about travelling. Kenneth doesn't see these as intention, but as part of the same exploration of the topological or a place. Place is inherently dynamic. This is one of the mistakes, I think, that's made. Place is not some simply staying here, doing nothing, not changing. Look around at Freiburg. Freiburg is what it is a place only through the movement within it and the movement between it and other places. And indeed, if the core notion and the idea of place, as I would argue, is the notion of boundary, the notion of boundary, of Grenze, only becomes evident in relation to movement. So places are constituted through movement. There's a lot more that one could say about this. I've talked about it in many other places. But that dynamic between staying and being underway is itself essential to the character of place. And finally, Nietzsche. Nietzsche is an interesting example to bring up here, because Nietzsche also has a very close relationship with place. He himself says of the Engadine that this is closer to him, in a way, actually, he almost repeats a passage that one finds in Wordsworth, almost like his own blood, right? So the Engadine, and I've actually written on this, I have an essay on towards a Nietzschean topology. Nietzsche is a topographical thinker, no less than Heidegger. It manifests itself in different ways, and it manifests it so much in Nietzsche's own personal engagement with place, whether it's the Engadine, or whether it's Turin, or whether it's Venice. And the relationship to Venice is particularly important. I'm not sure if you read Bertram's work, in which there's a lovely essay on Venice that largely reprises Zimmel's writing on Venice as well. The relationship to Venice turns out to be absolutely crucial to Nietzsche's own thinking, because what Venice represents is a mode of being in place that is both engaging, that draws us in, that allows the world to appear, and yet always is masked. And so Venice has all sorts of symbolisms for Nietzsche, but to suggest Nietzsche is Unterwegs just as much as Heidegger is Unterwegs, but both of them have an Aufenthalt in the same way, and in all sorts of different ways, in terms of their biography and in terms of their philosophy. So we could have a very interesting engagement with Nietzsche on this. But the Nietzsche example also exhibits something that I think is crucial here too, and that is the extent to which the topological lies at the centre of thinking and at the centre of many of the most important thinkers, and yet in a way that we almost constantly overlook and forget. So part of what I'm interested in doing is getting us as thinkers to turn back to the way in which our own thinking is embedded in place, not only to the way in which other thinkers are embedded, not only to the way in which the history of philosophy is embedded in place at the same time as it overlooks it, but to the essentially placed character, the necessarily placed character of all thinking, which means that all thinking is both Unterwegs and yet also Wundt, is also finds itself here. So thank you.
Yeah, vielen Dank.